Hi folks. This is the last episode in season 2, so please stick around after the episode for a short roundup of the season and overall plan for the future. It was a quiet Sunday evening in North Belfast on February the 12th, 1989, when solicitor Pat Finucane sat down to eat dinner with his young family. He was unaware that a stolen taxi cab with three masked men inside had just pulled up outside his home. His son, Michael Finucane, describes the terrifying moments he witnessed as these masked men entered their home.
There was a bang from the hallway. My father jumped up and slammed the door shut while my mother ran behind him and hit the personal attack button.
The men shot Pat 14 times in total, leaving him dead at the scene, wounding his wife and scarring the memories of his children for the rest of their lives. It was one of the most brutal executions carried out on a civilian and an officer of the court during the history of the Troubles. In this episode, I'll be explaining what happened as well as why it has gone on to become one of the most controversial murder cases in modern British history. This is the Troubles podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. In this episode, we welcome as a guest writer and co-producer Malachy O'Neill to the Troubles podcast. Malachy is a writer and film producer based in the United States who grew up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. Malachy wanted to say that, quote, "As someone who lived through the last two decades of the Troubles, and who has been directly impacted by the violence and destruction of the conflict, this podcast has been a great help to me to engage and reflect on my own past. I hope this episode and the podcast as a whole will serve as an important resource for those trying to understand more about this dark period of our history." This episode deals with one of the most complicated legal cases in British history, with much of the official information still not available to the public today. The events surrounding the murder of Pat Finucane have been slowly unfolding over a 30-year period. We will attempt to unpack the details of this case for you in a way that helps you understand not just the event itself, but the various layers of people, organisations and investigations that were involved. The majority of the information we've included is sourced from the main inquiries into the case. That's the investigations by Sir John Stevens, Judge Peter Corey and Sir Desmond De Silva. All the way through, we'll be highlighting where the key information was sourced as best as possible, while telling the compelling story of Pat Finucane's life and murder. Now, let's get on with the show. The shadow of the Troubles had long been cast over Pat Finucane's life. Born into a Catholic family and raised in the mainly Republican Falls Road area of Belfast, the conflict between the Catholic and Protestant communities was an everyday part of life. The eldest of seven brothers and a sister, he and his family were forced out of the area by Loyalists in 1969. His father lost his job and the large family were plunged into a great financial difficulty. Pat eventually left Belfast as a young man and was the first of his family to attend university at Trinity College in Dublin. It was while studying law he met and fell in love with his future wife Geraldine, a young woman from a middle-class Protestant family. During Pat's years away in Dublin, his own family were drawn into the rising paramilitary activity back in Belfast. Three of his brothers would all be connected to Republican activism over the next few decades. John Finucane was reportedly killed in a car crash while carrying out an IRA operation in 1972. Seamus has been linked with the Provisional IRA as far back as 1976, being arrested alongside hunger striker Bobby Sands while carrying out a fire attack on a furniture store. He was also engaged to Mairead Farrell, who would later be killed with two other IRA members in the Gibraltar shootings, which was covered back in season 1. A third brother, Dermot Finucane, was arrested in 1981 and sentenced to 18 years after being caught with weapons following an attack on a British Army patrol. He escaped Mays Prison in 1983 and later avoided extradition after he fled to the Republic of Ireland. By 1981, Pat was established as a solicitor, and he had become well known for his work defending clients with links to the Provisional IRA, and was described as one of the main solicitors acting on behalf of the Provisionals, according to RUC intelligence sources. His most high-profile client was hunger striker Bobby Sands, who was elected to the British Parliament and died in the Mays prison. He also defended members of the INLA who died in Mays prison, and as well as that he defended Pat McGowan, who was charged in connection with the corporal killings, which we'll get to later. It's important to note that Pat Finucane has never been linked with any paramilitary group other than representing clients during his work as a solicitor. In the various comprehensive legal reviews carried out on behalf of the British government, there has been no suggestion that he was ever a member of the IRA or had any direct involvement with their organisation or activities. After representing Bobby Sands, Finucane's profile had grown enough that the loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Defence Association, or UDA, began planning their first murder plot. The UDA was an umbrella name for various loyalist groups that formed in 1971 to combat Irish republicanism. They were responsible for over 400 murders and many large-scale attacks, including the Top of the Hill bar shooting and the Milltown massacre. This was a powerful organisation whose senior members had been tracking Pat from his early career right through to his death. Finucane's status as a target for the UDA was well known by the authorities even at this early stage. One unnamed agent within the British Secret Service, quoted in the 2012 De Silva report, described his notoriety at the time. Quote, "One target stood out above the others. This was Pat Finucane, a solicitor with strong Republican connections who was closely involved with Bobby Sands." The seriousness of this plan was weighted by the fact that the UDA had solid knowledge of the security arrangements at Finucane's office. The security service agent even provided details of the supposed gunmen and his chosen method of attack, if an assassination attempt was to be carried out. This plan was ultimately abandoned, but not before the decision was made by the RUC Special Branch not to act on this very real and imminent threat to Finucane's life. They were aware of this threat and decided against informing Finucane about it, to protect the agents that were feeding them the information, and because they thought Finucane would share the information and possibly compromise the RUC Special Branch's own operations. I've mentioned them before in the Lochan Island episode, but the Royal Ulster Constabulary's Special Branch, known simply as Special Branch, were one of the main intelligence services working in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. Based inside the RUC, they were described as the force within the force. And their main aim was to disrupt any and all paramilitary activity by recruiting double agents to gain valuable intelligence. They worked with MI5 and the British Army to collect and collate information on the various paramilitary factions and organisations that were active during this period. I know it's quite dense, but understanding how all these intelligence agencies worked will be key to unpicking the complexities of the Pat Finucane case. By 1985, the threat to Finucane's life had been significantly heightened, and another attack was being planned. According to the De Silva report, his home at the time was located near a strongly loyalist area in Belfast, and he was now viewed as a priority target for the UDA. This planned attack was also known to various levels of intelligence services, including MI5, RUC Special Branch, and British Army Intelligence. Once again, the plan was abandoned and no warning or protection was offered to Finucane from any of the authorities. The De Silva report stated that, quote, "Whilst the UDA did not actually attack him in 1985, he was left exposed and potentially in danger as a result of the failure of the state to take proportionate steps to seek to protect him." It was only 3 years later that the UDA planned their third and final attempt on Finucane's life. While the other two times had been known by the authorities, there was no indication that they had any direct involvement in the planning. But in the years since, they had developed a much more hands-on approach, according to well-known UDA member Ken Barrett. Here Barrett talks about a secret meeting he had with a member of the Special Branch.
When you met him first time, what did he actually say to you about Finucane?
Just that Pat was one of their men who was an IRA man, and he was dealing with finances and stuff for him, and he was a bad boy, and if he was out, like, would have a lot of trouble replacing him, stuff like this.
It wasn't the first time Finucane had been falsely accused of being a member of the IRA, but now the stakes were higher than ever. It was clear that Finucane was not only a prime target for the UDA, but it seems that he had become a target to those who were meant to be protecting him, the security forces. So what exactly had Finucane done to deserve this prime target status? In just under 10 years, Finucane had built his reputation as a skilled defence lawyer, one who was using the rule of law to hold the authorities accountable in Northern Ireland. He had constantly highlighted their criminal actions, from the mistreatment of Bobby Sands and his fellow political prisoners in the Maze prison, to the misuse of plastic bullets by the RUC on innocent victims. Finucane's commitment to uncovering human rights violations made by the state meant that he was no longer simply being ignored by the authorities. It was 1988 when Pat Finucane was in the news for yet another high-profile case against the state. He was representing the family of Gervase McCurr in an inquest into his death along with two other suspected IRA members, Eugene Thoman and Sean Burns. 6 years earlier, the three men had been travelling through a police checkpoint near Lurgan when members of the RUC opened fire on their vehicle. It was a shocking incident, even by Northern Ireland standards, with 109 rounds shot at the unarmed men as they were driving through an RUC checkpoint, killing them all at the scene. This was one of the many incidents during the Troubles that fell under the notorious shoot-to-kill policy, which has been previously covered in our Loughall ambush and Gibraltar shooting episodes. It was a covert policy where the British Army, RUC and SAS were instructed to shoot suspected paramilitaries on site, with no intention of making an arrest. It has been argued that this policy was justified because most of those who were killed were engaged in criminal paramilitary activity. Others looked at the shoot-to-kill policy as a violation of basic human rights. Pat Finucane was fighting for McCurr's widow, Eleanor, to reveal the truth about what happened at that RUC checkpoint, and what part the apparent shoot-to-kill policy had to play in her husband's death. The RUC men involved had already been acquitted in 1984, but because new evidence had been unearthed, the inquest was allowed to move forward. On the very first day, Finucane was part of a walkout in protest about the restriction of information being placed on proceedings. Here's Pat speaking about the problems that they faced. The inquest was effectively viewed as a whitewash, with the judge ruling that the RUC officers didn't need to be brought in to be cross-examined. Finucane and his client withdrew from the inquest before filing for a judicial review at the High Court in an attempt to get the RUC officers to testify. Because of this review, the proceedings were soon halted. In turn, this small victory earned Finucane the title of the shoot-to-kill solicitor. It was yet another mark against him by those who wanted to see him dead. Later, in 1988, Finucane was walking out of court alongside known IRA member Pat McGowan. He had been defending McGowan over allegations that he was involved in the corporal killings, which was viewed as one of the most dramatic and harrowing incidents in the Troubles. It was a case that was at the sharp end of a series of tit-for-tat attacks that included the Gibraltar shootings, the Milltown Cemetery massacre, and ended with the televised broadcast of a Republican funeral procession attacking and killing two British Army corporals. It was seen as a high peak of public violence in Northern Ireland's history and seemed to be pushing the country towards all-out civil war. McGowan faced charges of possession of firearms, grievous bodily harm and murder, but Finucane successfully argued that there wasn't enough evidence to convict. McGowan walked out of Crumlin Road Court a free man with Pat alongside him. As they walked out, a photographer took a picture that would be featured in the newspapers of the day and would become integral to the planning of Finucane's murder, which we'll learn about later on. The brutal execution of two British Army corporals was fresh in the public conscience. It had incensed the British authorities and loyalist paramilitaries alike. It would prove to be a tipping point for those figures who wanted to get rid of Finucane once and for all. 4 months after this photo was taken, Pat would be dead. On February 12th, 1989, the day of Patrick Finucane's death, a local UDA quartermaster placed two handguns inside a safe house located in the Loyalist Shankill Road area. Later that day, a Ford Sierra taxicab was hijacked by three members of the West Belfast UDA and then delivered to the same safe house where a hit team was waiting. The hijacked minicab was then driven the short trip from the Shankill up the Lower Antrim Road and into Fort William Drive, where the Finucane family lived. Their home was an attractive red brick house on a quiet middle-class street. As the taxi pulled up outside, Pat, his wife Geraldine, and their three children were eating Sunday dinner in their kitchen. Moments later, the front door burst open with extreme force. Finucane stood in the kitchen doorway while his wife sounded a panic alarm as two of the masked men entered the house. They led off two rounds, shattering the plate glass window in the kitchen door and sending Pat crashing to the ground. Geraldine recounts those fateful moments.
If you had been sitting in your kitchen having your dinner with your young children and somebody had come in and fired X amount of bullets, I mean, there were 14 bullets in Pat. After the RUC forensic team left my kitchen, I found all the bullets that they had missed, which were everywhere in the kitchen. Left, right, centre, everywhere. The horror never leaves you. I don't dwell on it. I don't try to recollect it, but it doesn't go away.
As the gunmen unloaded a number of rounds into the target, Pat's eldest son, Michael, shielded his two younger siblings. One stray shot hit Geraldine in the ankle, while the others struck Pat in the head, neck and torso, killing him instantly. The two masked men immediately exited the Finucane home, hopped in the getaway vehicle and made their escape. It was a simple plan carried out with brutal efficiency. But who exactly was responsible? The next day, Finucane's murder was immediately claimed by the Ulster Freedom Fighters. The UFF was a cover name often used by the UDA to deflect from the main organisation and allow it to continue its legitimate status. They stated that the attack was carried out on Finucane because he was a senior member of the IRA, a claim that has never been proven or supported by any official source. The actual murder was carried out by a tight-knit unit called the West Belfast Brigade, who were already known to authorities. This powerful battalion within the UDA were committing a string of violent murders on Catholic civilians and Republicans during the late 1980s. It was a unit that was at the centre of Loyalist violence and boasted some of the most feared personnel in the entire organisation. One of these individuals was a man we heard from earlier, Ken Barrett. He was a high-ranking member of the UDA and one of the masked men who was at the Finucane house. In 1991, the main investigator into the Finucane murder case, RUC Detective Johnstone Brown, first interviewed Barrett about the murder. Here he describes that first meeting.
So, I asked him, who murdered Mr. Finucane? And he replied straight back, hypothetically, me. So, I mean, if he had a slap in the face, he couldn't have got my attention quicker. I remember turning around in the car and looking at him. And he was sitting with his hands and his eyes blazing, just pump, pump, pump. He put his hands down into the footwell of the car and he was holding an imaginary gun. And he could see where he was discharging the gun into Mr. Finucane's head. He was reliving it. It was actually happening again to him. By his very actions, he was expressing how he had enjoyed it. He was boasting about it, gloating over it. And he said that as he was pumping the bullets into this man's face, they were coming back up by the stone floor. And he was still dodging them in the car because he was reliving this trauma. There's no doubt about it.
It was a stark confession that encouraged Detective Brown to look deeper into the Finucane case and seek to arrest Barrett for the murder. But it wasn't long before his investigation ground to a halt. Brown was quickly warned to move away from the case by his RUC colleagues. He also claimed that the recording of the first meeting between him and Barrett was deleted and replaced by a later meeting with no confession. Brown was sure that he was being obstructed in his investigation, saying, quote, We could have wrapped that up in something like 2 months. I know that. We weren't allowed to. We were not allowed to do it. Every obstruction they could think of. Brown's investigation came to an abrupt end when a threat to his life was reported to the RUC. Only days before, it was Barrett who had warned him that his life was in immediate danger from people inside the RUC Special Branch. In fear for his life, he abandoned the investigation, meaning Barrett remained a free man. According to Barrett, he was only a foot soldier in the operation, and the brains behind the Finucane murder was Jim Spence, who was the commander of a subunit of the West Belfast Brigade. His profile as a hardline loyalist in the Upper Shankill Road area afforded him the respect of the UDA's inner council, the highest ranking members of the organisation. It also allowed him to make important connections in the RUC that would be essential in the planning of Finucane's murder. Barrett claimed that Spence had first suggested the hit on Finucane and introduced him to an RUC Special Branch officer who would further encourage the operation. Here Barrett explains what part Spence played in the Finucane murder.
If you understand what I mean, he wasn't actually involved in the business end.
Okay.
Do you understand what I mean? He would have arranged, if you know what I mean, or set it up, but he wasn't actually involved in the actual...
The execution.
The end product, if you get what I mean.
With the help and encouragement of his special branch contact, Spence was able to convince senior members of the UDA to push ahead with the attack. He even secured a clean getaway for the hit team with the removal of RUC checkpoints near the Finucane home. It should be noted that Jim Spence has repeatedly denied any involvement in the killing of Pat Finucane. There are no official accounts of Spence being involved with the Finucane murder, and his name does not officially appear in the 2012 De Silva report, although many key names were omitted from this government-sanctioned investigation to protect the continued work of the security services. Spence was also allegedly responsible for organising the weapons that would be used by the two gunmen who entered the home. He contacted William Stobey, a UDA quartermaster and weapons expert, who handed over the two pistols for the hit on Finucane. These weapons were stolen from a UDOR military base. So while Jim Spence was managing the Finucane hit on the ground level, there was a figure working in the shadows who was the nerve centre of this entire operation. The man in the shadows was Brian Nelson, who was the UDA's head of intelligence in the mid-1980s. Nelson was recruited to gather information on leading Republicans for targeting, and it was he who would choose the people who would be shot in many cases. His part in the Finucane murder was to provide an information pack to senior members of the UDA, known as personality cards. These P cards were compiled by Nelson with known addresses, security arrangements, routines, and often photographs of the targets. Nelson allegedly staked out the Finucane home with other UDA members and sourced that infamous tabloid photo of Finucane and his client Pat McGowan leaving court. Nelson's P card on Finucane was essential in the planning and execution of his murder. There's a lot to take in here, so let's quickly recap on the various figures involved in the actual murder. There was Ken Barrett, one of the three-man UDA hit squad that carried out the attack on Finucane. The UDA quartermaster, William Stobey, who sourced, prepared and placed the guns at the safehouse ready for the hit team. Both of these men answered to Jim Spence, who was the commander of the infamous B Company in the West Belfast Brigade, who allegedly organised the hit on the ground level with the help of his RUC contacts. And finally, there's Brian Nelson, the man who supplied all the information needed to make the hit a success. Of these four publicly named suspects connected to the Pat Finucane case, Ken Barrett, William Stobey, Jim Spence and Brian Nelson, all four have been reported as informants for the RUC Special Branch, MI5 or the British Army. But it would be over a decade until the authorities would make any arrest in connection to the Finucane murder. It was the spring of 1999 when Lord John Stevens, then the Deputy Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police Force, was tasked with reinvestigating the Pat Finucane murder. Stevens knew from his two previous investigations that the Finucane murder was one of the most controversial cases in the history of the Troubles, and searching for the truth would be fraught with danger. During the first inquiry in 1990, the RUC station where Stevens and his team were based mysteriously burned down, destroying much of the evidence that they had compiled. The fire was never fully investigated, and years later Stevens became convinced it was not simply a coincidence. The third and final look at the accusations of collusion between the British security forces and loyalist paramilitaries would be the most damning of all. It would also lead to the first significant arrests relating to Finucane's murder. As of writing, there have been a total of 5 official investigations that looked into the Finucane murder and its connection to collusion between the state and loyalist paramilitaries. As we've already mentioned, Lord John Stevens was in charge of 3 separate inquiries over the course of more than 15 years, from 1989 through to 2003. An independent inquiry was started as a result of the peace process talks held in Weston Park in 2001. It began in 2002 when the British and Irish governments appointed retired Canadian Supreme Court Judge Peter Corey to conduct his own investigation. The final person to look at this case was Desmond De Silva in 2012, but this would only be a review of the documents with no new witness accounts of evidence. All 5 inquiries would report some form of collusion present. In 1999, William Stobie was the first person to be arrested as a result of the investigation. He was initially arrested on a murder charge, but this was changed to aiding and abetting those responsible for the Finucane murder. The trial itself was attracting interests from all sides of the conflict, but especially the Republican community, who had long held suspicions of police collusion. Up until this point, the police had categorically denied any involvement in the shooting. During the trial, Stobie admitted supplying the weapons to the gunmen who carried out the attack, and that he was an informant for the RUC Special Branch. One of the most shocking claims made by Stobie was that he had informed his RUC handlers that there was an attack being planned 2 weeks before the murder of Pat. In 2001, the trial collapsed when the key witness was unable to give evidence due to a mental breakdown. The prosecution dropped the case and Stobie was acquitted. Not long after, Stobie backed the Finucane family's campaign for a public inquiry. 2 weeks later, he was shot dead outside his home in the Glencairn area of Belfast. The murder was claimed by a paramilitary collective known as the Red Hand Defenders, who said that he had committed crimes against the loyalist community. Fearing that he was next on the hit list, Ken Barrett escaped Northern Ireland with the help of the Stevens Inquiry team. It had become common knowledge among his UDA colleagues that he was reporting to the Special Branch, and graffiti scrawled on a wall in his native Shankill Road declared him a tout, a slang term for police informant. He was also secretly recorded by a documentary team giving his opinion on who he claimed was truly responsible for the Finucane murder.
Killing of Pat Finucane was organised by the police. The dogs in the street knew it. Everybody knew it. They set the murder up. They wanted Finucane dead.
His admissions to the documentary team and the Stevens inquiry led to his arrest in 2003. Barrett pleaded guilty to all charges he faced, which meant the case would hear no evidence and no witnesses would be compelled to give testimony. Barrett was sentenced to 22 years in prison, in the only conviction secured for the murder of Pat Finucane. It was viewed by his family as a blatant cover-up, and his son Michael Finucane summed up their views after the conviction saying, quote, "The conviction of Ken Barrett has done nothing to lift the lid on who directed, ordered, financed, and facilitated the murder of my father. We are as much in the dark after his prosecution regarding the exact involvement of the security forces and security services as we were beforehand." Just 3 years into his sentence, Barrett was moved to Northern Ireland and released under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. He is rumoured to be living in England anonymously under the protection of the government. Then, in 1992, Brian Nelson faced his own criminal trial after being charged with over 30 offences, including 5 of conspiracy to murder. As we heard earlier in the podcast, Nelson was a key figure in the planning and execution of the plot to kill Pat, collecting and supplying vital information for the operation. It would soon emerge that he was also one of the most valued informants for the British Army, and was at the heart of all loyalist violence throughout the 1980s, and probably deserves his own episode. Born and bred on the Shankill Road, Nelson signed up for the British Army's prestigious Black Watch Regiment when he was only 17 years old. After being medically discharged in 1970, he began working with the UDA. In the early 70s, he was sent to prison for his part in the kidnapping and torture of a partially sighted Catholic man. It was a crime so brutal that Nelson's own family were shocked at his involvement. While serving his 7-year sentence, he resolved that he would work for the military intelligence services. After a short time working in the UDA, he moved to Germany to work in construction. But his intelligence value was rated so highly that the army tracked him down and asked him to re-enlist with the UDA as a covert British agent. In 1987, he returned to Northern Ireland to become the UDA's head of intelligence and a key informant for the Army's notorious Force Research Unit. The Force Research Unit was a covert unit of the British Army working primarily in Northern Ireland. Their main goal was to infiltrate paramilitary groups, mainly the IRA, with double agents to gather valuable intelligence that could be used to combat paramilitary activity. In theory, they were supposed to work closely with the RUC and MI5, sharing information to defeat paramilitary groups and protect the public. Their involvement in the Northern Irish conflict is seen as controversial, with ongoing accusations of collusion and criminality between agents and their army handlers. During his position as a double agent, Nelson was alleged to have played a vital role in a series of murders, attempted murders, and conspiracy to murder. A further 16 murders or attempted murders occurred as a result of his intelligence targeting, along with a large-scale smuggling operation from South Africa that supplied loyalist paramilitaries with arms for decades after. For years, Nelson had been feeding information to his handlers on the people that were carrying out the violence and who would eventually kill Pat Finucan. In a statement given to the First Stevens Report, Nelson said, quote, "I can only speculate as to why no action was taken against the individuals that I was associated with, considering the mass of information I accumulated against them over the years. I can only speculate this was done in order to protect me." Some might argue that this protection extended to his 1992 trial, where a plea bargain was agreed to drop the two most hefty charges of first-degree murder. As Nelson pleaded guilty, there would be no major examination of any evidence, allowing the trial to be fast-tracked and completed in under a day. During the trial, he was strongly defended by Army Colonel James Gordon Kerr, who was the head of the FRU. Kerr claimed that because of the information that he gathered, Nelson was responsible for saving the lives of over 200 people, and was also a major part in foiling a plot to kill Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. He received a reduced sentence of 10 years after pleading guilty to 20 charges, none of which were connected to the Finucane case. He would end up serving less than 5 years in total. While serving his sentence, he compiled a personal journal packed with the details of his years working with the UDA as an agent for the FRU. In one passage, Nelson highlights just what it was that kept him coming back to the dangerous life of a double agent. Quote, "I was bitten by a bug. Hooked is probably a more appropriate word. Working at the level I did within the organisation, one becomes enmeshed in a web of intrigue, conspiracies, confidences, danger, and the power of being aware of things that others around you aren't. The deadly game of working undercover and putting your wits against those who you seek to compromise. The power of this phenomenon acts like a drug, and the more you experience it, the more you want it." In his role as an FRU double agent, he received significant support, which critics have said amounted to deep-rooted collusion. All of his paramilitary activities were apparently known to, and in some cases facilitated by his handlers at the FRU. According to the De Silva report, there were allegations that his army handlers had helped him streamline intelligence materials for over 300 targets, as well as safely transferring the documents to a discreet location. He was gifted a taxi to use in covert surveillance missions and even handed the addresses of potential UDA targets by his handlers. According to Stevens, Corey and De Silva, without Brian Nelson, the Finucane operation would not have been possible. It was Nelson's intelligence pack, otherwise known as the P-card, which was used to target Pat. It was Nelson who passed on the infamous tabloid photo of Finucane leaving court alongside Pat McGowan to senior members of the UDA. He was even alleged to have impersonated a window cleaner with another two UDA members to stake out the Finucane home. Most importantly is that Nelson claims that he made his army handlers aware that he was compiling intelligence on Finucane weeks prior to the murder. The army apparently passed this information over to the RUC, as was standard procedure, yet they did nothing to prevent the attack, much the same as the two previous murder plots in 1981 and 1985. Pat Finucane was never alerted by the authorities to the threat on his life. Brian Nelson was released from prison in 1996, and his identity was kept secret until his death from a reported brain hemorrhage in 2003. He was reported to have been battling lung cancer in his later years, while living with his family in Wales. His death has been viewed by some as suspicious, considering it was the exact same week that Lord Stevens made his final report, where Nelson was one of the central figures being named. All three arrests and convictions, Stobie, Barrett and Nelson, were the direct result of the important work carried out during the final Stevens inquiry. Over the course of 14 years, the Stevens team compiled more than 12,000 witness statements, 32,000 documents and over a million pages of material in all. At the head of it was Lord Stevens. He faced down paramilitary threats, acts of sabotage and obstruction from the highest levels. Lord Stevens made his final overview and recommendations in 2003. In his final report, he detailed collusion between the state and paramilitary groups, stating that, quote, "The coordination, dissemination and sharing of intelligence were poor. Informants and agents were allowed to operate without effective control and to participate in terrorist crimes. Nationalists were known to be targeted, but were not properly warned or protected. Crucial information was withheld from senior investigating officers. Important evidence was neither exploited nor preserved." The findings unearthed by the Stevens investigation had a deep impact on policing in Northern Ireland and changed how the conflict was viewed. Even so, the Finucane family were critical of the Stevens inquiry and never acknowledged it as a significant part of the truth-finding process. They dismissed it both in how it was conducted and in how it was delivered, highlighting that they were not involved in the process, were not invited to view the case files, and that the final report was only partially released. 1 year later, Judge Peter Corey came to his own conclusions in his independent investigation. He had been looking into six separate incidents of collusion across the Troubles, which included the Pat Finucane murder. Much the same as in the Stevens inquiry, the team working for Peter Corey also faced intense pressure and alleged obstruction. Judge Corey opened up in 2019 about how the investigation was compromised by MI5, who removed and wiped hard drives containing vital evidence. Fortunately, all the files were backed up in hard copy, but it was clear that the truth about the Finucane murder was being actively covered up. The final findings of the Judge Corey inquiry echoed the Stevens report, stating that, quote, "Some of the acts summarised in this report are, in and of themselves, capable of constituting acts of collusion. Further, the documents and statements I have referred to in this review have a cumulative effect. Considered together, they clearly indicated to me that there is strong evidence that collusive acts were committed by the Army, FRU, and the RUC, SB, Special Branch, and the Security Service. I am satisfied that there is a need for a public inquiry." The call for public inquiry was welcomed by the Finucane family, who restated their calls for a full and open inquiry. Later on, Pat Finucane's wife, Geraldine, later declared her suspicions of a high-level conspiracy that had previously only been a rumour. In a private conversation with Judge Corey, he told her that he had seen important documents related to her husband's murder marked with the title "For Cabinet Eyes Only." It is a claim that taps into one of the most important mysteries about the Finucane case. How far up the ladder did the knowledge of Pat Finucane's assassination go? Answering this question is quite difficult, as there is still so much information that hasn't been made available to the public. The sharing of intelligence between the government agencies and the leading figures in Parliament is something well guarded many years after the fact. Separating facts from the rumour and hearsay can often be difficult when discussing the history of the Troubles. Though there are several hints in the Finucane case that might shed some light on who knew what within the halls of power. It was mid-January 1989 in the House of Commons when Douglas Hogg made his now infamous statement to his fellow MPs. It would have a lasting impact on the Troubles and in turn Pat Finucane and his family. Hogg said, quote, "I have to state, as a fact, but with great regret, that there are in Northern Ireland a number of solicitors who are unduly sympathetic to the cause of the IRA." The full significance of his statement was realised just 3 weeks later, when Finucane was murdered. As Hogg was a junior Home Minister at the time, he was being updated by security forces, specifically the RUC, on security measures in Northern Ireland. In declassified papers released from the Irish government, he is said to have been reciting from a precise official briefing and wasn't acting spontaneously, but on the advice of sources within the RUC. As Hogg was the Home Office Minister at the time, it's a clear indication of the level of information made available to high-ranking politicians. He was widely criticised for his comments and accused of inciting violence against Northern Irish solicitors working under the threat of attack every day. The 2003 Stevens report found that Hogg was compromised by his RUC sources and that his comments were not justified. This wasn't the only report of cabinet ministers having in-depth knowledge of the internal workings of security forces in Northern Ireland. It was at Brian Nelson's trial in 1992 when the head of the FRU was outlining how important Nelson was in the gathering of intelligence. Colonel James Kerr stated that his information was so high quality that his role was known by Tom King, the Northern Ireland Secretary of the day. Years later, in the wake of the 2012 De Silva report, Lord King would apparently declare that there was no need for a public inquiry, as the matter was now closed. He had been an opponent of the Nelson trial and of any public inquiry into the Finucane murder. Pat Finucane's son, Michael, criticised Lord King during a hearing in the United States House of Representatives. He accused him of having a major conflict of interest, considering he was in office at the time and receiving briefings from all three intelligence services working in Northern Ireland. The trinity of intelligence services working in Northern Ireland consisted of the RUC Special Branch, the British Army's Force Research Unit, and last but not least, MI5, otherwise known as the Security Service. All three intelligence strands, national level, civilian law enforcement, and military, were present in the earliest days of the Troubles, but largely acted as independent entities. It wasn't until the simultaneous IRA assassination of Lord Mountbatten and ambush at Warren Point in 1979 that a major shift in coordination occurred. It was the Warren Point massacre in particular, where 18 soldiers were killed by an IRA attack, that caused so much embarrassment to the British intelligence community. It was an issue that the British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher desperately wanted to solve. Under her watch, the establishment of tasking and coordination groups were commissioned in Northern Ireland. These groups resulted in more communication between the three intelligence gathering operations in Northern Ireland. It also linked together the policies and operations of the intelligence community. It also meant that MI5 would gain a comprehensive overview of each and every intelligence operation across the province. Again, this is quite dense, so just a quick clarification. MI5, or the Security Service Agency, is in charge of protecting British democracy and combating terrorism and espionage within the United Kingdom. It's a civilian agency with no formal executive powers or powers of arrest and detention. They work alongside the MI6, which is primarily concerned with international intelligence. They fall under the authority of the Home Secretary, and it has been suggested that they hold secret files on over 250,000 individuals at any given time. While the roles played by the RUC Special Branch and the FRU in colluding with Loyalist paramilitaries has been established for quite some time, the position of MI5 was less pronounced. The tentacles of the Security Service reached much deeper than previously thought and were firmly wrapped around the Pat Finucane case. According to the 2012 De Silva report, MI5 were also running many of their own agents in the UDA. For many years, they carried out a smear campaign on Finucane's name, using propaganda to suggest that he was a member of the Provisional IRA. They even gathered information of the plot to murder Finucane over 7 weeks prior to his murder. One key finding in the De Silva report pointed to the awareness level of senior government in the operations being carried out in Northern Ireland. The lack of structured guidelines for agents handling across all three strands of intelligence services during the conflict had long been a bone of contention. Senior RUC and MI5 officials had been repeatedly attempting to set down a proper framework for the handling of agents, which was discussed by ministers at cabinet level. It was also a specific issue raised by the Director General of MI5 directly to Prime Minister Thatcher in 1988. This is just one small example of how the stream of information might have flowed through the intelligence services and up to the political masters. MI5 are tasked with compiling information from their source and briefing the most important political figures at the time. The exact nature of this communication and how much specific information was known by the most senior members of the British government can be very difficult to pin down. These interactions, structures, procedures, and historical documents are fiercely defended by the Security Service, who maintain that the protection of their ongoing work is of paramount importance. In short, there is no surefire way of knowing how high the collusion reached without having a clear view of all the intelligence related to the Finucane case. The opinion of Geraldine Finucane is that the collusion ran right to the top. After private conversations she had with Judge Peter Corey and the existence of the documents marked for Cabinet eyes only, she said that she believes, quote, "the Prime Minister of the day knew exactly what was going on." It is a claim that Judge Peter Corey has never confirmed, and any official accounts, documents or records that might back Geraldine's claims have yet to surface. What we can be certain of is Maggie Thatcher's significant influence on Northern Ireland and the Troubles throughout the 1980s. Thatcher was a divisive figure who really does deserve her own episode in the future. Her position on the Republican resistance was one of resolute opposition, characterising their cause as entirely criminal. From the RUC's shoot-to-kill policy through to the extreme treatment of the 1981 hunger strikers, her aims were to break republicanism by any means possible. In the same year that Finucane was murdered, Thatcher spoke at a Tory party convention, reaffirming her views that the IRA were simply common criminals. There has never been any official source of evidence to indicate that Thatcher was directly involved in the murder of Pat Finucane, nor has there been substantial proof that she supported, allowed, or had knowledge of his targeting and murder. In the various official British government inquiries, reviews, and investigations, the allegation of high-level government conspiracy has been carefully refuted. It has now been over 30 years since Pat Finucane was gunned down in cold blood as he ate dinner with his family. During this period, his family have tirelessly campaigned for a full public inquiry into his murder. The calls for a public inquiry have then since been recognised and backed by a vast number of state officials, government bodies and international political institutions. Among those who backed a public inquiry were four Northern Irish political parties, Sinn Féin, SDLP, Alliance and the Greens, as well as Amnesty International UK, the Irish government and a group of 24 senators from the United States Congress. The review by Sir Desmond De Silva was set up by David Cameron's Conservative government in 2011 to answer these calls for a public inquiry. De Silva concluded that there was extensive collusion present between members of the state and loyalist paramilitaries, but no overarching government conspiracy. The report stated, quote, "There is no evidence that ministers had any foreknowledge of the murder of Patrick Finucane, nor that ministers were subsequently provided with any intelligence briefing suggesting that the intelligence agencies had foreknowledge of a threat to Mr. Finucane's life." In response to the many revelations of the report, which were mostly derived from the findings within the Stevens and Corey investigations, British Prime Minister David Cameron made this open statement to the House of Commons.
"The murder of Patrick Finucane in his home in North Belfast on Sunday the 12th of February 1989 was an appalling crime. He was shot 14 times as he sat down for dinner with his wife and three children. His wife was injured, and Pat Finucane died in front of his family. Sir Desmond's report has now given us, I believe, the fullest possible account of the murder of Patrick Finucane and the truth about state collusion. We should be in no doubt that this report makes extremely difficult reading. It sets out the extent of collusion in areas such as identifying, targeting and murdering Mr. Finucane, supplying a weapon and facilitating its later disappearance, and deliberately obstructing subsequent investigations. Mr. Speaker, the collusion demonstrated beyond any doubt by Sir Desmond, which included the involvement of state agencies in murder, is totally unacceptable. We do not defend our security forces or the many who have served in them with great distinction by trying to claim otherwise. Collusion should never, ever happen. So on behalf of the government and the whole country, let me say again to the Finucane family, I am deeply sorry."
It was an unprecedented admission of collusion by a sitting government, an apology that aims to be the last word in the Finucane case. The Finucane family firmly rejected the findings of the 2012 De Silva report and labelled it as a whitewash and a sham. They highlighted that they had absolutely no input into the findings, the main culprits identified were already dead, and that it was conducted by Desmond De Silva, a lawyer who had clear ties to the Conservative government. They renewed their call for public inquiry immediately after the report was released. In 2020, Pat Finucane's son, John, who, as of writing, is the current mayor of Belfast and a member of Sinn Féin, reinstated this desire for truth. Here is John speaking at a joint committee in Irish Parliament.
It is incumbent upon the British government to heed the words of my family, but if they continue to ignore my family the way they have done, then they need to listen to those around the world who continue to support us.
There has been certain criticism of the pursuit for a public inquiry, with DUP member Sammy Wilson recently arguing that it would be a waste of taxpayer money and disrespectful to the many victims of the IRA to pursue a public inquiry. This was not the position taken by the UK Supreme Court in 2019, who ruled that all the previous investigations were incomplete and insufficient. With this ruling from the highest court in the UK and the reopening of the case by the Council of Europe, the pressure on the government to finally open a public inquiry is stronger than ever. What is often forgotten under the sheer weight of all the information and the intrigue of murder, espionage and state collusion is the legacy of Pat Finucane as a human rights lawyer. He regularly used a rule of law called habeas corpus that would force police to present prisoners before a court, establishing basic rights for political prisoners. He was also one of the first Northern Irish lawyers to bring a case to the European Parliament in Strasbourg and defined his career as a defence lawyer who fought against a system of law designed to strictly benefit the state. With more than a hint of irony, Geraldine memorably said, quote, "Pat would have represented the people who shot him." Throughout the 30 years since her husband was murdered, Geraldine has tirelessly campaigned to find out the truth. It seems fitting to end on Geraldine's own argument for a public inquiry and the importance of truth, no matter how long it takes to uncover. "My family and I have campaigned for a long time for a public inquiry. However, we are not prepared to settle for just any form of inquiry. How the process operates is just as important as the establishment of one. An inquiry that is not public, effective, independent, or fully prepared to allow my family to participate to the maximum extent is not an inquiry worth having. We would not accept such an inquiry, and neither will the wider public who have very serious concerns about the circumstances of Pat's murder. I believe that it is a mistake to ignore cases of serious concern just because they are in the past. I believe the only way our society can move forward into a peaceful future is by examining the controversies of our past and exposing them fully for all to see. I believe this creates foundations of confidence upon which a lasting peace can be built." That's it from me. Thanks and see you next time. Hi folks, Oisin here. The episode is finished, but I'm just going to talk a little bit about the future of the podcast for those who want to stick around. So this episode concludes season 2 of the Troubles podcast. It's been a really great year and a half, and especially this season, I've got some amazing feedback from listeners all over the world. The podcast is creeping up on 1 million total downloads, and it regularly charts in over 30 countries around the world, and there's a fairly large listenership in Ireland, the UK and the USA. So just thanks for listening. I'm really glad that you're interested in learning more about this dark period in history. The only way we can ever pave a future is by learning from the past, and I firmly believe that the Troubles are an extremely important part of Irish, Northern Irish, and English history. So, what's in store for the Troubles podcast? I'm quite confident I can keep going up to at least 4 or 5 seasons, maybe even more. The research for each episode has a tendency to uncover more potential episodes. But for now, I'm taking a few months off. The podcast has received some excellent support from Patreon, and as well as that, I've added advertising this season, but unfortunately, I still have to work a full-time job. So I'll be devoting some time to that over the next few months. I'm planning on setting up a tour company in Ireland, specialising in hiking and active tours. So I need to knuckle down and focus on that. I also have a substantial reading list of Troubles-related books and want to get working on the framework for season 3. It's really important for me to get people on the podcast to tell their own stories, as was the case with Richard Moore. So I'm going to prioritise that in season 3. If you want to reach out and give feedback, suggest an episode, or suggest an interview, you can find me on all social media platforms or simply send an email to troublespodcast@gmail.com. I'm particularly interested in speaking to ex-soldiers who were stationed in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. I'll be leaving the Patreon up and running, so if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. I'll be making sure to update my Patreons with some videos and recommended reading lists during the break. In the next few weeks, I'll also be having an interview with Malachi, who wrote this episode and will be telling us about his connection to the Troubles. He will also be asking me a few questions about the podcast, so make sure to check that out. If you want to support the podcast with a once-off donation, you can also do that at buymeacoffee.com/troublespodcast. Over 100 people have bought virtual coffees for me throughout this season, so I just want to say thanks to each and every one of you for your support. If you want to support the podcast in different ways, you can just tell your friends or leave a review. Everything helps. That's it from me. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next season.